So, we're back yet again with another episode of In a Perfect World. And, you know, I'll say this is today, this is very late March 2017 for the listeners, and I'm in the field doing a recording with Dr. Gillian Ross, who is the author of the most recent book, Consciousness Versus Catastrophe, Reflections on the Next Stage of Human Evolution.
Wow.
It sounds very
grand,
pretentious,
doesn't it?
Yeah. And sort of slightly...
Bring them in immediately.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that that is almost the polar opposite of where I find myself today on your lovely property here, just behind the Nimbin Rocks, right outside the town of Nimbin in New South Wales. And it's a beautiful sunny day. I'm really in love with your land. This is such beautiful... sweeping vistas in front of us. Maybe I'll take a photo and share it with the listeners.
That would be nice. Yes,
but it's very nice. I think we talked originally. I heard you on Bay FM, a local radio station.
Yes,
and the reason I wanted to reach out was that so much of what you're saying was, thoughts and reflections and wisdom that I have stumbled across myself in different facets of my own personal journey. And even down to some of the phraseology and some of the concepts. And I was like, wow, I felt a kinship with you, Gillian.
Thank you.
And
yes.
I really wanted to connect. And it's so nice to have these type of discussions in the container of nature. And to
Isn't it? Yes.
How was your day been?
Yes. Well, I've been on the ride on mower most of the day before you arrived because we've had a day of sunshine instead of rain for a change. But it really is such a delight to be interviewed. A, about my book, and B, on my favourite space, which is on my temple deck, with this beautiful vista and the sun shining. And
well, how would you describe it for listeners? Where are we and what is this space?
Well, not very good. I've built a little temple here on the land with the view of the Nimbin Rocks and the Nimbin Valley, and it's terribly lush and green. We're so lucky with all, and we complain about the rain, but in fact, it is very welcome.
Yeah.
And it's just a beautiful space, and I'm very into beauty. It's a very soothing experience for the soul, and I think that one of the ways in which humankind has fallen by the wayside a little is not appreciating or drinking or nurturing or nourishing the soul with beauty enough. There are those elite artists and those an elitist perspective on those things, but just for ordinary people, for every day, to find beauty somewhere is wonderful.
Well, do you think that's perhaps a little bit of a lead into some of the book's concepts? Like, what is this sense of catastrophe that is in the title of your book? And is it due to the fact that we've fallen out of this relationship with beauty and with nature?
Oh, yes, that's a huge part of it, isn't it? I like to begin my spiel about the theme of my book, which is introducing readers to the philosophy of evolutionary spirituality. It's been described as that, and I'm happy for it to be called that, but we'll talk more about what evolutionary spirituality is saying, anon, presumably. We are heading clearly humankind or Western civilization, which is now global civilization, seems to be on a high tech, high consuming joyride into an abyss, doesn't it? Into the extinction at the moment. There are so many crises besetting us. And
I often say the same thing, right?
Yeah.
Name some. What are
name some?
Because,
oh, darling.
Because you know what? The powers that be, governments, the politicians, the people
sitting
like that,
out to argue with me when I started
wrong. No. What I want to do is go deeper because the powers that be say, well, it's business as usual. It's our perspective. We've got to cut down the forest because we need to put more cows in there to make McDonald's burgers or something.
Darling,
they sort of refuse to see that we actually
Yes, those who are in denial or those who would argue that. I mean, it's clear that our whole economic structure was predicated based on the assumption of limitless resources. And we're now realizing, of course, we haven't got limitless resources in terms of energy and food and so on. We're on a planet with limited capacity. So then the answer to that, of course, for some is that we can find another planet and so on. There are all those arguments there. But, I mean, climate change alone is a crisis at the moment, and the implications of that for migration of people. And we've seen that the intimations of that last year with the influx of people into Europe I don't think we really need have to go there. You know, there are books written on it at the moment that there are so many crises besetting humanity in terms of drought, fire, flood, migrations of people, poverty, the increasing divide between the rich and the poor, the possible rise of fascism because democracy isn't working. You know, there are so many things happening and converging at this time to wake us up to a new way of being.
Do you think people see them as separate, discrete problems, or do they see that they're almost like dominoes all, you know, hitting one another?
I don't know. I think most people are just struggling with their lives, with their finances, with their mortgages, and not really wanting to know a lot of them. There is that sleepiness amongst us, isn't there? So, in a sense, my theme also is bring it on. You know, there has to be further chaos and deconstruction before we begin to come together as a species, collectively, and address the questions that are facing humankind at the moment. I love to quote Eckhart Tolle on this. We have to face a stark reality that we must evolve or die, you know.
That's always been the way, though, hasn't it?
No, not at all. The crises besetting us at the moment are unprecedented, not least because of the number of people on the planet. Not at all. There isn't a single atom on the planet at the moment that is not impacted upon by human consciousness and behaviour. This is totally unprecedented. The fact that we have pile of nuclear weapons, you know, in existence that can blow up the planet any day now. Trump, in a moment of rage, could set off a nuclear device or set, you know what I mean? With his tiny hands. These are unprecedented things. There's nothing like before. No, not at all.
There was Bay of Pigs, there was nuclear war for the last 70... Nuclear fears of war for the last seven years.
Yes, that doesn't mean to say we've been bloody lucky so far that it hasn't erupted. We've had a few clear close shaves and, you know, there wasn't a Trump in power at the time. And there are more nuclear weapons now than there ever been. I understand that the risk is even greater than it's ever been. But people have got used to it, so they don't march in the streets anymore. Mm. But that is one aspect of the problem. But just sheer population. And I mean, at the moment, we've got a terrible drought in Africa with literally thousands of children starving. I mean, this is not right. It's glaringly not where we're meant to be. I mean, we can have visions of what the planet could be like if we got our act together, if we became less selfish, less narcissistic, less and more global in our thinking.
Do you think that's a flaw in the system, that it's people have become desensitized, and you're saying about the mortgages thing, and everyone's sort of distracted by culture in general, actually, because it's put the blinkers on. But do you think that's just a byproduct of this system, or do you think there's a conscious choice that some powers that be within creating the system, maybe they haven't seen the repercussions in the long term, or like, how do we get to this stage?
Well, you might have heard of a chap called Ken Wilber, an integral theory, right? So they started to map consciousness, because we are, as we like, you could say that evolution has reached a stage where consciousness is paramount. We have the evolution of matter from light. We have the evolution of the biosphere of life from matter. Now we're at the epoch or the stage or era, whatever you like to call it, where we're looking at the evolution of consciousness, because consciousness has sort of come into its own through humankind, the human species, its capacity to reflect on where it's been, where it might go, and having an enormous power through its consciousness, through its technology, through its history, through its cultural inheritance of knowledge and so on, building on knowledge, all of those things has brought consciousness to the fore. So in answer to your question, Wilber and his colleagues have mapped this evolution of consciousness through various stages. I like to see it as the experience of Western culture rather than generalize it to evolution at large. But as far as Western culture is concerned, we've seen a move from the shamanistic or magical, through to the traditional, where there was the church and the state, through to the modern, where science took over and we had this, you know, birth of atheism and scientific materialism, which gave us a massive push in our technological skills, our scientific skills. And then we went to postmodernism, which started to question the whole thing, and pluralism and the relativism of truth and dismantling all of that, and the rise of environmentalism in that era, and then where we're at now, according to evolutionary spirituality and evolutionaries and Wilber and others, we're on a transition from that to post-postmodernism, which is the first rung of what we call transpersonal consciousness, because it's calling forth a massive shift in consciousness out of the separate self, out of the ego, which has dominated all the other levels of consciousness, one might say, for the last few thousand years, and is now at a point where it has to be either transcended into a higher state of consciousness, a state of consciousness that the mystics and sages and Gandhis and Martin Luther Kings and, you know, Nelson Mandelas have manifested for us in the past, has to become the consciousness of humanity to take us into a whole different framework, a whole different worldview, which is more compassionate, more collective, more
holistic.
Yes, exactly. Reconnecting us with the riches of the sacredness of nature and the sacredness of our own inner being. So it's a reconnection with the divine, but not in a traditional old way with the God in the sky sort of stuff, you know, completely different, but a reconnection with the sacred. So all that is where we are at the moment in this extraordinary critical time in history. We're at this transition, this shift from egoic to post-egoic, or I like to say from ego to essence or ego to snowflake self. It's a very different concept of who we are.
And what is the snowflake self?
Snowflake self is the self that has reconnected with its divine source, which surrenders to that divine source, which feels guidance, not my will but thy will be done, right? And that senses at a profound level the interconnectedness of everything. Mm. It's the mystical consciousness. But it has many different levels. We just begin on the lower rungs. Again, we have it mapped for us by the mystical traditions. You know, Tibetan Buddhism in particular has described and mapped, or whatever the word would be, these different levels of consciousness, which can begin to be stable, which can become to be, in quote, normal consciousness for humanity, not just a weird experience, not just a transient experience, but something that becomes embodied and manifests in the world.
I know on your website you describe yourself as a sort of a cross between a Christian Buddhist yogi mystic. And so what are some of those qualities? Or you're talking about the Buddhists and some of their traditions. Let's go a bit deeper. What are some of those qualities, or what are some of the pathways? Or
Indeed. And on that score, it's interesting, because I heard the lovely Andrew Harvey, who's one of my favourite teachers, and I believe him to be one of the most impressive scholars and mystics on the planet today, in his knowledge and the depth of knowledge and breadth of knowledge of mysticism and mystical traditions, said recently that we're entering the age of universal mysticism. And that's rather beautiful. What he's saying there is that we're, for the first time, again, unprecedented, through our wonderful internet, through our technology, which has its, you know, its shadow side, but it's also, as you know, its wonderful side, its lighting up side, that we can now have access to all the wisdom and knowledge of previous traditions, including the shamanic, of course, which you're very familiar with. That we now have we're in a position, if we could transcend this contracting egoic consciousness, we can harvest the riches of all of this to create, to bring forth as the next stage of evolution, a whole new humanity. We'd have to give it a different name, you know, Homo Universalis has been suggested. Mm. Different species, really, once we get out of that fear-driven, contracted, competitive consciousness of the ego, which has served us well in a way, but it is time to move beyond it. So what was your question? All right, so what do we learn from all of this? Well, would you like me to list a few differences between the ego and the snowflake self?
Well, please.
So it'd be very tangible for people.
Yeah, let's cross them off the list.
Yes, because I think at this stage, you know, snowflake self is a rather nice name for it, because just as the water, every snowflake is a unique condensation of water, we are each a unique condensation of the divine in our snowflake self. And uniqueness is a very lovely aspect of it, to honour our uniqueness, to honour ourselves as a drop of the ocean of light. And Andrew speaks of us being a light drop in an ocean of eternal light, which is very lovely too. But snowflake is quite appealing because it has the flavour of instability. And I think at the moment we are, you know, we're both in our ego and our snowflake self, most of us. We can have a taste of our snowflake self, what it means to have a global worldview, to have compassion that extends beyond just our local friends, but to all beings, you know, as the Buddhists speak of. And yet we also very easily flipped back into a reactive egoic self. So one of the big differences between ego and snowflake self, which you can become very aware of, is that the ego contracts or reacts to situations. The snowflake self responds to situations. In other words, it learns, takes on board or rejects whatever's happening. It doesn't immediately contract and say, whoops, poor me, you know, I'm going to get back at you or whatever, which is very much an egoic reaction to things. So that's one big difference. The other is, of course, that the ego self does see itself basically as a separate self. Therefore, there is always an impulse to struggle for survival, you know, to compete. Yeah. You might not compete with your own family, but that's about as far as your compassion and your sense of, you know, being more than just separate goes. You might feel yourself a part of the family or even friends and so on, but you have difficulty in really feeling a connection with anything much beyond that. Whereas a snowflake self, because it's had some profound mystical experience of oneness, be it a transient one, has a memory of that and can really feel at a deep level, not just intellectually, but feel that interconnectivity, that belonging, that sense that we are indeed all drops of the same divine intelligence. We are being orchestrated by this divine intelligence, and that we're being called now to surrender to it and listen to it and flow with it. So that's another important difference, whereas the ego has great difficulty with surrendering. It's too fearful.
So how do we learn to reduce the ego and let the snowflake self...
Well, this is a very interesting one. But if we go back to our high-tech joyride into the abyss, clearly the ego is driving the vehicle, and we have to change the driver, and we have to change the driver to the snowflake self. So how do we do? Well, we do it through spiritual practices of an authentic kind. One of the wonderful things about evolutionary spirituality is that it brings one out of this preoccupation with the little self. I mean, a lot of spirituality has been hijacked by this my enlightenment, my wisdom, my success, my, you know, they're all geared to that sense of ego again. So we have to be, the snowflake self emerges or is nourished by mystical experience, basically. Jean Houston said recently, which I thought was wonderful, she said, the greatest accelerator of human consciousness on the planet at the moment is mystical experience. Because it's only that will help us to step out of that narrow egoic frame of reference. Einstein talked about that too. He talked about the egoic prison and our need to extend our consciousness beyond our limited family and friends to care for all sentient beings. And that's, again, a description of our step from ego to snowflake self. And the importance of nourishing that transition or bringing about that transition through a daily spiritual practice of meditation, of connection with what the Sufis call the inner beloved, our divine source. I love that expression. Don't like God, it's too patriarchal. But anyway, the inner beloved, which is an internal connection that you feel to this divine other, which is both ineffable and, you know, the mystery, or you could call it the mystery, but you still get a certain personal sense of connection with it in a meditation practice, especially with tantric practices. We might talk about what that means. And so that nourishes and brings online, let's use a local, a contemporary expression, brings online the snowflake self. So then it's a matter of doing practices regularly, consistently, and with the right intention and motivation to stabilize it. It's so important. It could be just transient. We get glimpses of it when we're walking in nature, when we look at a child, when we feel love for our child and so on. Of course, we have inklings of that snowflake self. But to have awareness of it and to nurture it is the call of the time. Because coming out of that snowflake self is a sense of purpose and gives meaning to life. Because you recognize that you have a unique gift to offer from the infinite. And to find that is to find your groove in life, is to follow your bliss. As Joseph Campbell used to say. So, you know, it's hard to believe that kids or teenagers who are suicidal, who are depressed, who don't seem to have any direction in life, would feel that way if they were given the messages of evolution and spirituality.
Mm.
And one of the great things about that philosophy is that it takes us out of that narcissistic preoccupation with little me, to trusting that there is a bigger story and that you have a role to play in it. And that in itself is so liberating. It immediately releases us from a lot of the contractions that people spend masses of money going to try and release from one workshop to another, you know.
Mm.
My pain, my mother, you know, my childhood, etc., etc. Sure, there is pain there. But if you have a philosophy and a framework that takes in the bigger picture and that gives you some hope of finding a different level of consciousness, that is so healing and so liberating. So gradually, with that realization, the snowflake self will begin to replace the ego, and you'll know when you're in one rather than the other. You'll learn from that, and that's where we're at. That's where I'm at.
You know, we had an interesting little conversation before we started recording just about... You were almost interviewing me. We were talking about, you know, my work with different plant medicines and the shamanic path. And I was explaining a little bit about, you know, how in context you could say that they're sort of a peak experience and they can reveal a very mystical reconnection both to the self, the deeper self, to nature, and to deep source. You know, that all those, the depths of possibilities are there to connect to. But I was saying the more I've been on this path, the more I see... Western culture, it's almost as if you say they're hungry for an authentic reconnection to the soul, and that does seem to be the primary driver, I think, of the shamanic movement. It's not just for
Absolutely.
A physical cleansing on a health level, it's more for this hunger of something that is missing that people want to reconnect to, and the plant medicines seem to be a very tangible way. But I mean, to the same degree, there's such a movement of, you know, meditative culture now and non-dual awareness, and even technology is getting in on it with, like, you know, neurofeedback and things like that, and in training people through technology to achieve these states of mind which are reducing or, you know, re-subsuming the ego and allowing that deeper connection. And so what I was saying I'm really interested in is this container of how we do these things, and I think it comes down to what you're saying, is that there needs to be a daily practice, which obviously isn't doing psychoactive medicines every day, but it's about integrating those peak experiences into a container of a life, you know, in a community and being in service. But there needs to be more and more structure to help integrate those peak experiences with those people that do plant medicines. And there is quite an overlap of shamanic culture and the meditation cultures that I know of now.
Mm,
there's
mm.
a growing mm. connection between the two. So I guess I'm really interested in what you have to share. We're starting to talk a little bit there about ways to reduce the ego or bring it back into right relationship with the overall soul or, snowflake self. What are some practices? What's your meditation practice?
Well, this brings us to it again. Yes, there's so much there that you've said, darling. It fires off things with me.
Mm.
One important aspect of this transition, and I do go back to this, I'd love your readers to really take on board this note, this idea that we are moving through a very critical transition from what the integralists call from first tier to second tier consciousness. It's a whole new ball game once you get from ego to transpersonal self.
Mm.
And that is so important that we take that step now, because that's what's going to save us. That's what's going to ensure that there is some future for humanity on this planet Earth. Because if we go the way we were, clearly, you know, we're into the abyss. So it is sort of critical that each one of us has a role to play in that. So what are the practices? I mean, I totally honour your shamanic work. That again is a part of our healing, that we must reconnect with the wisdom of the shamanic worldview and the plant medicines and all those things, because one of the I consider the pathologies of Western culture, and I don't agree with Ken Wilber and his friends that it was all meant to happen and, you know, everything's going to be fine at all.
Mm.
I think Western culture took a very serious, made a very serious error of judgment or his unfortunate history of an overly severe patriarchy, which disconnected us from the feminine. It didn't just dissociate from the feminine and bring up the masculine energy. It crushed the feminine energy.
Mm.
It crushed our sense of the sacred. It crushed our relationship with our inner life. are in a realm. That's all very, you know, the mystery of the feminine, the divine feminine. And that is it split the body and mind, which on the one hand has given us our iPhones and our computers, but at great cost to our wisdom. And in a way, you know, we are like kids who've been given guns at the age of three, particularly applicable to Trump at the moment, of course, where our technology far exceeds our wisdom to use it and to deal with it. So we've got that imbalance in Western culture. So I am getting around to answering your question, darling. So our practices have to very much heal and bring up the feminine side of our nature, which is not male versus female, as you well know. It's about masculine versus feminine energy, which we have within each one of us. And so reconnecting with the sacredness of the land through the shamanic traditions is a very, very important aspect of our healing, I think, for people to go out into nature, and if they can find a shamanic guide, join your groups or whatever you're doing, because I think it's very important to have someone who knows what they're doing in these matters. Find an authentic teacher.
Yep. Okay.
And at the same time, you say that they are cleansing experiences, but I think we have to be very aware of shadow work to a degree, that we have to clear some of our stuff in order to receive the light energy of the snowflake
self. Totally agree.
Yeah. There's a lovely anecdote there from one of my teachers, which I really love, which says, in moving to this new state of consciousness, it's as though we're rowing our little boat across a stream, and there are ropes holding us back, tied to boulders on the land, right? Some of those major boulders and ropes we have to release somehow through whatever process, smorgasbord of psychotherapies at the moment for dealing with those things, and maybe, you know, magic mushrooms or whatever could be help in that. I don't know enough about that, but certainly whatever technique works for you, find some way of releasing yourself from the major ropes, but don't get obsessed with that, because you can go on clearing the ropes ad infinitum. People get obsessed with workshops where they're just working on their personal stuff and they go round and round chasing their tails. And part of that anecdote is that when you've got yourself halfway across the river, the light from the transpersonal on the other side draws you to it. So there reaches a stage where you don't have to worry about the ropes. They get melted by the light. Does that make sense? So, but, you know, it takes a while to reach that point. But that's where we want to be, so that we're sufficiently clear that we can then experience the light of the transpersonal, and it will then guide us and nourish us, because it wants to be within us. It wants us to be the snowflake self. It wants us to light us up as a light drop self. And all we have to do is shed some of the veil, shed some of the clobber, and it will be there to move us forward, which I think is a very positive and hopeful way of looking at it. The other aspect I'd like to say in terms of what we do is that I think we're also at the time of the collective. You know, it's been said that the next Buddha is not going to be a person, or the second coming is not a person, but a collective. It's a collective. So we're seeing more and more that people are actually coming together to meditate. They're creating fields of meditation, fields of light. I'm doing it here on this land with a group. You know, people are coming in and we're meditating together, either physically or virtually. This is the other gift of the internet. Groups are coming together across the planet, hundreds, thousands, focused on perhaps one teacher or one philosophy or one tradition, and they're coming together, and that raises the consciousness of humanity far more than any one person can do sitting in a cave. One way of visioning it, again, comes from Andrew, that the light drops, his version of a snowflake self, they're lighting up across the planet. And networking, so you can see these lights connecting with one another. So you're getting a web of light, which Teilhard de Chardin predicted as the noosphere, the field of energy around the planet, to create a whole new way of being for humanity, which again is a very, very hopeful, beautiful image.
I like that. Do you think then that, you know, they usually say if you want to change the world, change yourself, right?
Yes, that's true.
But what you're saying is this idea of the, you know, the next Buddha or that next stage being a group endeavor, is the more that we're clearing ourselves individually and revealing the snowflake, which is the transpersonal self or the source self, which is in everyone, it's clearing the way. Is it making it easier for everyone? The more we work on
yes,
that ourselves.
Absolutely. It's the 100th monkey stuff. Definitely. That's the hope. That I think Wilbur says that I don't know what percentage it was. He claims that about 10% of the planet, of people on the planet at the moment, are in that what they call the integral consciousness, the snowflake consciousness, the first layer of the transpersonal. They call the integral because it integrates all the others, right? It doesn't judge it, that we're right and everyone else is wrong. It harvests the best of everything. The integral consciousness, and it rises above the ego. It has it's a global consciousness. So about 10% of the population, and I would imagine, you know, that if we brought that up to, 20% or something, there would be a snowballing effect. That, well, again, is very beautiful and hopeful that this is what we're going to hope for. Yeah. But as we said earlier, the structures, the social structures are so geared to a Newtonian worldview and an egoically based, consumerist consciousness, that I think there's going to have to be a bit of a meltdown before this new consciousness can really penetrate.
Brings us back to part of your title, The Catastrophe. Is the catastrophe not just inevitable, but is it necessary?
Yes, indeed. Indeed. I think some degree of meltdown is. I mean, who am I to pontificate about that?
There is a critical mass of people who are aware to whatever degree and are conscious and are trying to embody and implement a new paradigm, a new way of being, and then the system still, continually cuts people down. You've got to pay the rent.
I know.
You've got to do this and that. You've got to play the game.
I know.
And you've got one foot in the culture and one foot in the new, and it's dichotomy.
Well,
this
is a transition period, and any transition is difficult. I mean, the messages from evolution are that most of the great quantum leaps forward in the evolution history, and of course evolutionary spirituality goes into that, our new story of the evolution from the Big Bang and all the various stages we've gone through, which I think is, again, a very empowering story, if presented in the right way, if reduced with the sacred, not told in a scientific materialist way, but as a story of the infinite manifesting, growing, blossoming.
So beautiful quote you have.
What?
It's like, give like hydrogen.
Oh, yes, that's Brian Swim. We have to share that. Uh-huh. Yes, that's so lovely. Yeah. I came across evolutionary spirituality through Brian Swim in the 90s, and he had a video series called Catechesis to the Cosmos. But one of his ways of conveying to his audience the awesomeness of the story of evolution, which has been described as science's greatest discovery. His way of conveying this was to say, well, look, just imagine taking hydrogen gas, which is one of the first simplest elements to emerge from the primordial fireball, as he calls it, the emergence of matter from light. We had hydrogen. We know hydrogen gas from our school day science or whatever to be a colourless, odourless gas. You leave it alone for 30-odd billion years and it becomes giraffes, rose bushes and human beings. Now, you can't just embrace that as a sort of materialistic chance phenomenon. It is just so amazing.
Miracle.
Now that we're understanding more the subatomic particle behavior, scientists are telling us that even electron has a level of consciousness and choice,
Really?
We're beginning to see there's more going on in that hydrogen gas from the start than we ever realized.
Mm.
It's imbued with the intelligence of the divine that has been moving the whole story forward, in the most amazing way from the beginning, and we like to call it the eros of evolution, because we like to see it as the impulse of love into greater complexity, more beauty, to go back to beauty, more goodness, truth and beauty emerging from this story.
And is it really catastrophe if we consider that intelligence, which is nature, is continually moving itself forward, and it's almost like what we're in now is just a groove that we're sort of stuck in, and it needs to keep moving forward.
Yeah, maybe. We certainly need to kick up the arse, human species, in one way or another. And, of course, if we do go, there'll be lots... Life will continue in some form or other on planet Earth. And I'm sure now we know that there are trillions of other stars out there and universes and galaxies and so on. The size of things just becomes so vast that there's probably teeming with life out there, which I'm sure if we do move through this hiccup, eventually I could see that, there will be an intergalactic community, that somehow we will connect with those other forms of life. I mean, we're just dinosaurs. Who knows what the future will hold if we just manage to stabilize the snowflake consciousness, move through this period of meltdown and sow seeds for something much greater. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Very exciting. Again, you can fire young people. Swim talks about how if only children at high school, you know, were taught the story of the universe in the way that he tells it, in the way that evolution and spirituality tells it, what a different world it might be. Because I really think we have to, we say, what do we do? Well, it's obvious we have to teach our children a different story, don't we?
Mm.
And so far as we can. Now I'm bringing teenagers onto the land here. So this just flowed with that, but it's, I'm so pleased we're doing it because I just want to share that story with them.
Mm. Yeah.
And you can see their little faces lighting up, even, you know, quite, even primary school kids, let alone teenagers.
Mm. Do you do, like, meditation practices with the children?
Yes, indeed I do. Yes, one practice they always love is yoga nidra, which is a deep relaxation practice.
Mm.
Lying on your back, scanning your body, guiding with voice guidance. And they go into such a lovely space with that. They're very malleable when they come out, they don't believe anything, but they get an experience of just letting go a bit and softening and, going into stillness and silence.
Mm. Beautiful. Mm. I mean, that's the thing, I guess, you know, if kids are still connected to, you know, more of their snowflake self, or they haven't got all the imprints of culture and all the traumas yet of adult life, but then they can absorb that, and they can have those structures to grow, and then maybe that critical mass. If we could, but it, doesn't every culture try this? They understand that the children are like the seedbed, and they propagate their isms onto them. You know,
yeah. And we've done a very bad job of that, haven't we? Taken away any initiation ceremonies for the teenagers, and just prepared them like little cogs in a machine to go into the world and make money for the. For the rich who are already rich. I mean, one could be terribly cynical about it, but yeah, we've failed our children with our education system. Mind is changing, it's evolving, there are changes we see, especially in primary school. But one of the other factors there that I really feel is so important when we come to talking about how we've stabilized our snowflake self is again to change the model from that terribly frozen one of our being just flesh, blood and bone, and to introduce them to an experience of subtle energy, which is again why yoga nidra is wonderful, because they actually begin to feel and experience an energy flow through their body. Whoops, what's this, you know? And again, it's so basic and so simple, and we have the wisdom from the East, thousands of years of experience around subtle energy fields and you know, the etheric body and astral body and all those things. And yet Western culture has closed us off from that. Mm. It's solidified us. It's solidified the world. We have to thaw it out, starting with our children and letting them experience these different levels of energy.
The melt is a good thing, because it's not just that all the icebergs are melting and the polar ice caps are melting, but the ego is melting.
And the armouring of
the PTSD of the global culture is having to melt and to open up to what's revealed.
I hadn't thought of that. That's a lovely imagery, isn't it? It really is a meltdown of our body as well as of the ice caps.
That's a good thing. So, I mean, it's almost as if this
idea... we must let the little snowflake melt, though, must we? It's got to graduate to being a light drop.
But you know what? The snowflake is a certain form of condensation of moisture, which is everywhere and in a cycle of perpetual renewal.
Yes.
And the same with the source. The source can never be destroyed.
When it takes
this transitory form of the snowflake, right, and then the snowflake hardens into a ego flesh body, and we're remembering the snowflake, that's also a stepping stone to go a bit deeper and remember deep source.
Sure.
I mean, and the snowflake must melt.
Well, in terms of recognizing our own mortality, of course, absolutely. Yes, we dissolve back into the one.
What do you think of those, is it Buddhist traditions where they say that, you know, the purpose of life is to... harness consciousness to the degree of self-awareness that realizes it is conscious of consciousness that can transcend the body, and then when you step over into, you know, when your mortality hits and you cross over and leave the body, that your conscious snowflake self could remain autonomous in wherever we go, in the light or wherever.
Sure. Well, I suppose my response to that, darling, is that yes, I'm not particularly... This is the other lovely thing that I like about evolutionary spirituality, is not only its inclusiveness of all traditions and so on, but again, that it doesn't fall back into that preoccupation with what's going to happen to me, you know, afterlives, previous lives, survival, because again, you're focused more on the whole, on the whole. You're seeing yourself as a shard of glass in a magnificent stained glass window. You can't even see the vision. You're not interested in what happens to the little shard when the window breaks or whatever. You're just interested in what part you're playing in creating that holistic, superb vision in this moment in time, in this current moment on planet Earth in 2017. Sure, you know, we can extend metaphors to see what happens to snowflakes after we die, but I'm not concerned about it. For my own death, I'm not concerned about that, because I'm concerned about giving to my children the richness or wisdom, whatever I have to offer in my snowflake self to them, to then they're the ones who will then carry that on. So it's all about here in this moment on planet, on this gorgeous planet. We're looking at it now. What could be this beautiful experience, which brings me to the quote of the Dalai Lama, which I love, which says that the aim of life, and of course of spiritual practices, is to embody the transcendent. In other words, to be the snowflake self. Forget about what happens, you know, when you die or whatever. Just embody the transcendent here and now in every moment. That's what we're here to do, to reconnect with Source and allow Source to move through us.
Beautiful.
And be what we're meant to be.
So what do you think we're talking about? You know, it's almost as if this catastrophe almost needs to have a different word, because it's almost, you know, we're saying inevitable or necessary, and then as part of that, there's that quote from before you were saying that it's the evolve or die that Eckhart Tolle is saying, and that there's some type of emergence from the emergency, and without that emergency of the catastrophe, we wouldn't have that psychic pressure or that build-up of energy that forces us to look at ourselves and forces us to change. Where do you think this is going? I mean, obviously we're saying the snowflake self coming out, and we need to transcend, or there's this process in motion that's both individual and collective at the same time. Do you see that happening in the world?
I think we have to rest in a state of unknowing and humility on this. I'm not going to pontificate either way. All I know is all I have to ask the question is, what can I do at this moment in time? What do I see? What have I been called to do? Because the picture, the bigger picture, is too grand. I don't know. What I've said to you, what we discussed, and the philosophy of evolutionary spirituality as a framework for some level of understanding grabs me. It makes sense to me. But I can't go beyond that other than just, you know, do what I do in my spiritual practices daily, connecting with Source and feeling what is right for me to do in this particular body, mind that I'm occupying at the moment. So I wouldn't go there. What was I thinking? Yes, one thing that does come to light, to mind, is the understanding, because people can get intimidated by the whole thing. It is very too grand, and, you know, oh, it's all going to collapse, and et cetera, et cetera. Is the understanding from physics that when a system is under threat, when it's in a transition phase, as we are, it becomes unstable, and it can either collapse back, go into the abyss, or it can become more complex. It can take a step up, reconstitute itself, as it were. Okay, so we're in that transition phase with our consciousness, and the thing that scientists have recognized there is something called the butterfly effect, where a minute input of energy can be amplified and affect the outcome one way or the other. Does that make sense? So it's a beautiful imagery for us at the moment, in that everything we do counts. A smile rather than a grumpy reaction to somebody, or an understanding rather than a judgment or whatever. All of that can contribute to this tipping point we're talking about, you know, where we can go forward rather than slip backwards, this 100th monkey effect. So that's very encouraging too. It gives us, you know, no matter how in simple ways we can make a contribution to this bigger picture, and to be aware of that we can be butterflies in this scenario. Talking about butterflies is another lovely metaphor, which is of the caterpillar. You know, the caterpillar in the chrysalis. Apparently, science has shown that the caterpillar in the chrysalis is gorged with food, and it has certain cells they call imaginal cells. They're the first cells of the butterfly. And to begin with, the immune system of the caterpillar kills them, destroys them. But then eventually they become so, they proliferate so much that the caterpillar gives up, and the imaginal cells come together, and they blossom into the butterfly. So you can see the parallels there with humanity. We had imaginal selves like Christ, like Nelson Mandela, like the Buddha, like Martin Luther King, whatever, all these people, like imaginal selves in the chrysalis of the caterpillar. And we destroyed them. We crucified them or shot them or whatever. But now the imaginal selves, the snowflake self, in other words, beginning to proliferate to a point where we're going to produce a butterfly, a new humanity.
Yeah, I like that. It's a good analogy. And looking at the, it's almost as if the culture as a body feels itself under attack from these new ideas and these
the caterpillar body. Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't like it at all. And it's gorged with food and material well-being.
Which really resonates when you think of like the 99% and the 1% and the way that everyone, you know, they're just completely devouring the earth for the personal gain. It's the caterpillar's lust battle.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Beautiful.
It's a nice intro.
So
I have to acknowledge Barbara Marx Hubbard for that. She's one of the leading lights in, or leading, or founding, you know, women, founding, I'm losing the words now. Anyhow, founders of the evolutionary spirituality movement, the human potential movement. She's about 85 now. She's very impressive.
So, Julian, how did you find yourself at this cusp of writing the book Consciousness versus Catastrophe? I know you've, you know, done a lot of, we've got a few other books, and you've done a lot of yoga CDs and DVDs and been involved, I guess, in that personal development movement.
Well, you know, my story. Well, in terms of coming to write the book, of course, I was inspired by Brian Swim back in the 90s and Matthew Fox and Jean Houston. And I'd moved myself from academic life and city life because I just had the, I'd had an experience of yoga nidra, and I'd become a yoga teacher, and I just did, I realized I'd had to find a whole new life, a more alternative lifestyle.
Did you have some tipping point of your own, some awakening moment?
Oh, I think perhaps the birth of my children, really. The fact that I didn't feel that I was being an adequate mother for them, caught up in the stresses of city life and academic life. I had a journalist husband who used to go away a lot, so I was on my own looking after them and multitasking and doing all those things that a strong woman's expected to do. But there was a lost soul there, you know. I'd disconnected from my childhood mysticism. I'd become a good atheist, the way I was meant to be as an academic.
What was your childhood mysticism?
Oh, a very strong connection with Christ.
Come on.
No, I'm not ashamed. First chapter of one of my books is my story, because I think it's a lot of people can identify with it. A lot of people have really strong mystical experiences as children, really strong sense of the divine, but then they get it knocked out of them. I had it right up until my teenage years. I used to go off to church. I loved the local call, the local choir and the liturgy and the communion and the ritual
ceremony.
And yes, but I used to go on my own because I didn't have any friends, or my parents didn't encourage me or anything. I used to take a bus and go to the church on my own. But when I went to university, and I had a physics teacher who was an atheist and tried to talk me out of things, telling me those ideas were outdated and so on. And then I went to university. I went to what's called the Godless Institute of Gower Street, London University. And fell in with postgraduate psychologists who were really, really anti-religion. They couldn't stand Jung. If you entertain any religious ideas, even Jung, you were regarded as being either stupid or emotionally disturbed. And I didn't want to appear as either of those. So I shut up about my religion. And got talked into the thought that, right, well, in this day and age, those ideas are just nonsense, childhood dreams, childhood aberrations. And I suffered with that, for another 20 years before I reconnected with that sense of the sacred and the mystical.
I guess
it's like a starved child all those years, really. But as you say, what inspired me was the love that came up with the birth of my children. It was like a wave of some feeling that, you know, that brought back that memory of what I felt as a child, the mystery, the ineffable. And so I started going to yoga classes and then had experiences there, and then I chucked everything in, academic life, marriage, city life, and went off and explored these
It's a beautiful
alternative ways.
I think a lot of people may find themselves in the same way. We're talking about, you know, dissatisfaction perhaps with modern Western culture in the way it's not feeding the spiritual self or the snowflake self.
Absolutely.
But then there does come a point, doesn't there, when people have to make a choice, and regardless of the complexity or the difficulty, it's like you've got to feed that inner self. You've got to nurture it and listen to that that you feeling do. And intuition within yourself.
You do. And you have to be prepared possibly to live on the poverty line, which I did, you know, still do to some extent. And my God, it hasn't bothered me in the slightest, because there's been so much richness come out of that. And I had offers of, you know, university positions and so on. I didn't take them because I wanted to be at home with my children. So I became a yoga and shiatsu therapist and did, you know, wrote a book and did some local lectures for the WA, but had very little money, very little money. Mm. But enough to a roof over our head and food on the table. We had a goat and hens and grew our own food, and the kids loved it. We had a gorgeous time, you know. Mm. And I don't think they have any regrets that I couldn't buy them expensive toys or bicycles or anything. So, but it requires courage, of course. If you're so embedded with your three bathrooms and whatever other people have these days, and money they take totally for granted and don't know what to do with to some extent, I don't know. To just chuck all that in and decide to go and live simply somewhere can be a challenge.
Maybe this idea of catastrophe is that, as you said, in a sort of finite system of the earth and its resources, this ism of this Western carrot that keeps dangling in front of everyone for more and more and more and more is completely unsustainable. You know, China's has come online, a billion extra people who all want the Western dream now.
Yeah.
And it's completely putting everything into overload, not just China, but the whole world.
Yeah.
That if we don't have a, by choice, sort of declension from the unsustainability of that dream, then it's going to collapse on its own under the weight of its own.
Well, this is the catastrophe side of things. It cannot go on the way it is. I mean, one other solution, Mother Earth might bring on some sort of pandemic, you know, where we have to, one way or another, see an awful lot of death, of reduction of the human population, one way or another. I'm afraid, yes, it's hard to get a handle, because it is very, very scary when you really, really think of what could happen very quickly. Even in what's left of my lifetime, say 10 years, you know, what is going to happen? We are on the edge of really, really serious change. But all the more reason to carry a seed of hope and also a seed of meaning, in that you can do something. You can do something, even if it is just sowing a seed for something beyond the chaos, something beyond the catastrophe that will be, you know, left behind. Rather like the seed bank they've got up in the Arctic, haven't they, somewhere there? And not to fall into despair. And again, that's where spiritual practice is so important, because if you feel that connection with the beloved, if you have that inner connection, there is a part of you that knows it is all a play. It's not, you know, it's not the be-all and end. It's a dance.
Well, that's it. It's most people just, because they identify with their own self-ego, but then they identify with them as a player within the game of the culture and reality. But that's still an egoic identification.
Yes.
It's not transcending what our senses and the ego's showing us. There's no connection with something greater.
Yeah.
Without that, we're prisoners of the system itself.
Of a very limited scenario.
As the ship's going down.
Yeah.
And there's not enough lifeboats. So people would start to panic. So the key thing you say is, don't panic.
Yeah.
Go within, find that center, find that spark, fan the flames, connect. Let's activate that circuit of energy.
And also to awaken, because when we're looking at the differences in ego and snowflake self, of course, one fundamental difference is a capacity for compassion.
Mm.
That we're going to need an awful lot of compassion for the suffering that's going to arise with all of this.
Mm.
And that we have something to give there too, you know, those of us who are in a better position than some who are suffering so much. We're feeling that now, you know, what's going on in the Middle East and the refugee crises and all over the planet there is such suffering.
Mm.
There's a lovely Tibetan Buddhist practice called Tonglen. Do you know Tonglen?
No.
Oh, you don't know Tonglen.
This is the juicy stuff I want to know. Yeah, what are these practical takeaways?
What are you talking about? Practical practices. We haven't talked about tantric practices or Tonglen or anything like that. Tonglen goes back to about at least 1,000 years from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. Dalai Lama recommends it and, you know, teaches it. Many of the Rinpoches do. It's another favourite of Andrew Harvey's, I have to say. and very, very important for this time in our transition period, where you, first of all, you have to go into your snowflake consciousness. You have to feel the connection with the divine. That's very important. You don't do it from your ego. Mm-hmm. So you do a preliminary practice of meditation that takes you into that space of embracing the infinite, feeling the beloved. And then you visualize, first of all, someone you love very much, and you feel any pain that they have, and you see it as a black cloud coming out of their stomach, and you draw it into your heart and dissipate it in yourself. And then you visualize somebody having difficulty with it at the moment, right? And you do the same thing. You have compassion for them. You see their own pain and their own what's brought them to be the way they're behaving. You know, I'm visualizing Pauline Hanson these days, actually. Mm. See her very clearly and see all... You can see in her face the pain and the distress in that, you know, person.
See, most of the politicians are so
most
pain,
of them, absolutely. They all they do in their collars and ties. And yes, their bodies are full of pain. And to draw that out as a black cloud and bring it into your expansive, vast, divine mother heart. Mm. And then send them from that divine space, from that richness, send them love, send them compassion, send them whatever, you know, light. And you do that for the group too. You can do it for groups who are at the moment causing such damage, like the White House, I suppose. You can put them in your vision. So it's a very, very powerful thing to do. And, of course, in our ego self, the response is usually, oh, it's dangerous, you're going to be taking all that stuff on yourself, you know. And, of course, but if you're in your snowflake self, there's no problem at all, absolutely none. You just dissipate it into the light. If you contract in fear, stop doing the practice, because that's when you will do yourself some harm. Sogyal Rinpoche, you know, author of the Tibetan Book of the Living and Dying, was asked by one of his students, but isn't that dangerous? Might I not get sick? And he said, oh, that's great. It means it's working.
Yeah, and then someone can do it
so
for you.
So that's
and take
true
it.
Compassion. Yes, yeah. Yes. Wow. You don't care. You just want them to feel better.
What are some of your other favourite techniques? Or
well, I have a lovely tantric teacher called Sally Kempton from the Kashmir Shaivist tradition, Kashmir Shaivism, because we were talking earlier about shamanism. And you can look at religion, in terms, again, of Western culture, as moving away from shamanism, which is the repression of the feminine, into transcendentalism, taking the divine out there, away from the earth. The earth is all feminine and yucky and, you know, get the hell out of here sort of thing. Transcendental religion. And then we have, of course, non-religion, you might say, the modern era of atheism. But what we're merging now is a reconnection of the transcendental and the shamanic. In the form of tantra, which is being collected from the Eastern traditions, tantric traditions, where the immanent, the shamanic is seen as the feminine, the immanent divinity, symbolized, for example, in Hinduism as Shakti energy. And we raise that in our body, we raise that up literally, physically in our body through Kundalini energy or whatever, up through the top of the head and unite with the transcendent. And then that marriage is brought, that energy, marriage, or whatever you like to call it, union, is brought down, again, tangibly and physically, into the heart center and given to the world, so that we become the divine child of the union between the immanent feminine and the transcendent masculine. And that's a very beautiful image, too. The new human is the divine child of that marriage of the immanent and the transcendent. Which is, again, bringing those two great traditions together, the shamanistic and the transcendental.
Beautiful.
But in this modern, integralist way. Mm. So that's very much my practice, is the union of the you know, the feminine manifestation and the awakening of Kundalini. And Kundalini is awakening with a lot of people. That you know, again...
It seems to be, you hear anecdotally, at least I do, of people that are having spontaneous Kundalini.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Is there such a thing as spontaneous Kundalini? Well, there's a trigger or there's something.
Well, you might say
Shakti's
works in mysterious ways and does these, you know, happens. You can't sort of call her in. She just happens. So it can be spontaneous. But the thing about doing a daily practice of a tantric nature is that if it does arise, you're more likely to contain it in a stable way than have it completely, render you dysfunctional, because a lot of people who have a spontaneous Kundalini in their bodies are not ready for it. They're still very much in their pain body in many ways, fall apart. They can't handle it. You know, it is very, very dramatic. It doesn't have to be like that at all. It can be very, very gentle if you've prepared your body for it. Again, we haven't talked about, you know, again, this is a transition time. We have to look after our bodies as a vessel of the divine.
Exactly.
A snowflake body.
Yeah, yeah.
And not eat junk food and, you know, sit around watching television all day. I mean, I enjoy television too, but make sure you get exercise and good food. And we're so blessed because we've got that available. We can do that.
People just don't understand. They don't see that the body is a vessel for the divine, so they're not honouring the body.
No, that's part of that repression of the feminine again, isn't it? You know, I think Wilbur beautifully described it as the Western body. We're polarised between the energies of the left brain and the genitals. The only time we go into our body is for sex. The rest of the time we're up in our heads all the time, you know, this thought stuff, which doesn't help either.
Indeed. Wow. Okay, well, thank you for that wisdom. So where do you think this, with your book Consciousness versus Catastrophe, how long has that been out for now?
Well, it was self-published towards the end of last year. I've had one or two nice interviews, but I'm really very pleased with it, and I think it does introduce people to a new story, and a lot of references and quotes in it that are inspiring. You haven't got to...
I will get a copy.
I'm going to give you one.
That's right. How can people find your book?
Did I give you one the other day? Oh, darling, I'm so sorry. I'm sure. God, how stupid of me. That's terrible. How can they find my book? Well, I do sell it from my website, drgillianross.com. Dr. Gillian Ross, all one word. .com.
Gillian with a G.
G-I-L-L-I-A-N-R-O-S-S. Yes. D-R, the beginning. D-R, Gillian Ross. I sell it from my website with $25 including postage in Australia, but I mean I'll sell it for that overseas I think as well, but you can also get it from any bookshop online.
Great.
Hopefully.
Like it's a valuable contribution to the field and to the human awareness and some of the things we can do to help this emergence. And
well, those of you who have found it seem to have found it enormously helpful for them. I had very, very lovely feedback from people, including a collection of nuns, would you believe it?
I would believe it.
Who are becoming very disillusioned, or have been for a long time disillusioned with the church, Catholicism, but they're eco-spirituality nuns.
Really?
In the tradition of Thomas Berry and Brian Swim.
Wow.
And I actually do a monthly meditation with about 40 of them online.
Wow.
We've got our own field of meditational consciousness. Snowflake selves, who happen to be nuns, have made me an honorary nun.
Beautiful.
And it's very, very lovely. And they're all a lot of them who've come across my book have been really beautiful about it and helped to promote it.
And so that brings up, through your website, can people find you and can they also tune in with your online meditations?
Well, I like them to have sort of... I haven't got online meditations. I've got an email, group of people on email whom I inform when we're having a meditation practice here once a month. And mostly they have visited here. They've done a workshop here or they've visited the Pema Valley, as I call it, here. And then they can visualise being here. But look, I'm not going to be totally prescriptive about that. If anyone's very keen to know when we're meditating, of course. And I call it the Lemon Grove Meditational Field of Evolutionary Love. Because I told you the story of the Lemon Grove and how I came to this be here, guided by the search for a lemon grove. And here it is. We're in a lemon grove, wild lemons. And it was one of the people attending my last weekend when we were thinking about a name for our field. Said, how about the Lemon Grove Field? And that seemed lovely. The Lemon Grove Meditational Field of Evolutionary Love. Sounds a bit of a mouthful. And it has
beautiful.
Got an acronym.
Bumper sticker for you. Yeah.
So evolutionary love is the thing. It's all about the snowflake self and the emergence of a new field of love.
An old field of love coming back again.
Well, no, I don't know. It's all evolving and emerging. You know, remember, just as the acorn becomes an oak and we become who we are from a single cell, which is also miraculous, I believe so the universe in its flaring forth is evolving and blossoming into a It's like the same sort of thing. It's a living entity that is moving towards we do know not. We're little cells in it.
Mm. Beautiful.
Yeah.
On that note, perhaps we can draw to a close.
Could I share a verse from Christopher Fry before we go?
Please do.
Yes, because it sort of summarises my whole theme, and I can unpack it a little as we go, and I like to end any interview with this because it seems to summarise things for people, give them something to think of. It's from Christopher Fry. He wrote this in the middle of the last century, the dramatist, author, and it goes like this. Cold and dark we may be, but this is no winter now. The frozen misery of centuries cracks, breaks, begins to move. The thunder is the thunder of the flows, the upstart spring. And that so beautifully describes the meltdown, doesn't it, of our bodies and of the structures, social structures. But we have the upstart spring, new life coming up. And then he goes on, thank God our time is now, when wrong comes up to meet us everywhere, never to leave us till we take the largest stride of soul folk ever took. And that beautifully describes our step into the transpersonal, from ego to snowflake, step of soul. The largest stride of soul folk ever took. Affairs are now soul-sized. In other words, they're consciousness-sized. Soul-sized. The enterprise is exploration into God. In other words, mystical experience. Fine mystical experience. Exploration of God. Where are you making for? It took so many thousand years to wake. In other words, it's taken thousands of years, billions of years for consciousness to reach where it is now on planet Earth. It took so many thousands of years to wake, but will you wake for pity's sake? So that just says it all, doesn't it?
It does indeed. The largest stride the
soul folk ever took.
Let's start striding.
Absolutely, darling. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gillian Ross.
Thank you, my dear. It's been lovely to have you here with me this afternoon.
Yeah. Now it's time to go smell the lemons.
What time is it?
Aloha.